This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about work being done on the Central Coast to get farm-to-table dining into school lunchrooms.
When we tell a story about our food, we find that kids are more engaged with that. They're more inclined to eat that strawberry when they know the farmer that grew it and they've seen pictures of how it's grown on the farm.
And later, lavender, a plant known for its calming scent, and now local foodies are trying to get it into more dishes.
But it does work nicely as a spice. It has a savory kind of flavor to it. If it's done correctly, it's like using rosemary or sage.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, September 30th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. We kick off today's show with a polarizing topic, vaping. Last week, the State Department of Public Health urged Californians to stop vaping immediately, days after Governor Newsom signed an executive order to try and curb vaping among youth. And yet, unlike in many other states, the California legislature has yet to pass a single law related to vaping. From NPR member station Valley Public Radio, Carrie Klein recently spoke with Cal Matters politics reporter Ben Christopher about the status of vaping bills in the legislature.
Okay, Ben, so let's start with the executive order that Governor Newsom signed last week. What was in this executive order?
Sure. So this was just the first work day after the end of the legislative session. The governor came out on that Monday morning and announced that he was signing an executive order to direct the state's health regulators to crack down on black market vaping products and e-cigarette products, to develop new anti-vaping information campaigns targeted at young voters, and then also to ask his tax authorities to potentially reset the way that vaping products are taxed in a way that would effectively raise the taxes on those products.
And how does this compare to what's happening in some other state legislatures and governor's offices around the country?
Sure. So the obvious comparison here is with what Governor Andrew Cuomo just recently did in New York, and also what Michigan has done, which is to impose a flat ban on flavored e-cigarette products and vaping products. So these are bans on flavored tobacco products like mango or watermelon or even mint flavored. In New York, there is an exception for menthol flavored. But the point being that a lot of public health experts believe that these are uniquely appealing to young smokers, underage smokers. And so I think a lot of public health advocates were hoping to see something similar from Gavin Newsom, but the governor insists that he, under the California Constitution, he doesn't have the authority to go quite that far. So he said that this executive order is about as far as he can go, and he actually put a request out to the legislature next year to send him a bill that would impose such a ban on flavored products.
So why was an executive order even necessary here? I mean, didn't a number of state legislators already introduce their own bills to curb vaping earlier in the year?
They did. So at the beginning of the legislative session, there were more than half a dozen bills introduced to put new restrictions on this industry in various ways, including two bills that would have banned flavored products, but most of these bills either died in the legislative process or watered down so thoroughly that they were removed from consideration. Most recently, Assemblyman Adam Gray from Merced, he's the chair of the Government Organization Committee, which is, for obscure reasons, is the committee that deals with tobacco and smoking-related bills. He introduced his own bill, which ramped up enforcement of bans on underage smoking, increased fines, put some advertising bans in place on flavored products, and also put a limited ban on certain flavored products, but made an exemption for menthol and mint. That got quite a bit of pushback from public health organizations that felt like that was a loophole that was a bit too large. And so it became kind of a controversial piece of legislation. Eventually it was watered down to the point where it actually made a few tweaks to California law, but it was a fairly modest change. And then in the final days of the legislative session, just to get in the weeds here, Assemblyman Gray actually shelved the bill, saying that he wanted to come back next year in January to make it stronger, potentially shifting the way that taxes are imposed on vaping products in exactly the way that the governor has just suggested. And so I'm sure we're going to see the legislature pick up where they left off in January.
Okay, so Gray's bill got kind of watered down and eventually tabled. What happened to all the other ones that you mentioned?
So the two that would have banned flavored vaping products outright, one was killed in Assemblyman Gray's committee. It was killed there. And then another one was watered down in another committee. Those amendments that were made actually made an exemption for menthol and mint products. And the author of that bill, Senator Jerry Hill from Silicon Valley, he felt like that was the menthol and mint are particularly popular flavors. And so he felt like that was a loophole that was too large to stomach.
Okay. And so we've mentioned Assemblymember Adam Gray of Merced a couple times. And so, of course, as you said, he's the author of one of these bills that got tabled. But he was also in one of the committees or chairing one of the committees that ended up tabling some of these others. I mean, why is he kind of a recurring character here in the story?
Well, it's a good question. So Assemblyman Gray is the chair of this committee through which any tobacco-related legislation has to pass. And so he is inherently just has a role in these conversations. He's also considered a bit more moderate than many of his colleagues in the Democratic caucus. And so I think from the perspective of some public health activists, they were concerned that he was going to introduce legislation that was going to be a little bit too favorable to the industry. And so when he came out with his bill in July, which provided some tweaks to the law, but provided this loophole for menthol and mint, there was a lot of outrage and a lot of skepticism. They said that it was basically a scam or a window dressing on the issue. These public health advocates were able to negotiate with Gray's office to get to the point where everyone was in support of the bill. But I think everyone basically acknowledged that the bill that Assemblyman Gray eventually put forward was probably didn't go as far as they would have liked. And so it was kind of a surprise at the end of the legislative session when he announced that he wanted to hold off on the bill so that it could be made stronger. In other words, he's still not considering a ban on flavored products outright, but the fact that he wants to increase taxes on vaping products, I think, took some people by surprise.
And so all of this is with the backdrop that that Juul, one of the country's leading e-cigarette manufacturers, just in the last year has donated over $30,000 to Assemblyman Gray and some associated committees. I mean, is that significant enough to play a role here in how he's kind of managing and navigating these waters?
Well, certainly he would say no. I put this question to him, and he said that there is absolutely no connection between the money that he raises on the campaign trail and the public policy positions that he takes. It's also worth pointing out that because he is the chair of the Government Organization Committee, which deals with any tobacco-related legislation, that it makes sense that Juul would direct money his way. But certainly critics of Gray might draw different conclusions.
Okay, well, so the legislative session is now over. What's next when it comes to what action lawmakers or Newsom could make on this issue in the next couple months?
Well, it's a good question. So this executive order is going to go into effect. It actually asks the governor's health and taxing authorities to look into what those next steps are, how they could go about making tweaks to the state's regulatory structure in a way that doesn't require new legislation. And I'm sure, as the legislature is in recess for the next 4 months, lawmakers will be thinking of ways to take up this issue in January. And certainly, this has become a public health scare at the national level, and so I think this is on most legislators' minds in one way or the other.
Okay, well, Ben Christopher is a reporter covering politics and elections for CalMatters. Ben, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Hey, thank you.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Homelessness in California gets labeled a public health crisis time and time again. But for those living it, homelessness is a personal health crisis multiplied more than 100,000 times over statewide. The California Dream Collaboration is looking at solutions to some of the problems facing the state. Matt Tinoco of KPCC has this story from Los Angeles on how outreach workers are addressing some of those health needs.
It's a hot September morning, and I'm walking down a street in Venice, Los Angeles, with Dr. Coley King.
So here's Third and Rose.
It's a sprawling, block-long homeless encampment with maybe 30 tents under the beating late morning sun. King's one of the doctors in LA County who practices what's called street medicine.
These patients are very sick. These patients die very young. They need medical care. Let's get better medical care to them, and let's give them a better medical home that they can come into.
King works out of a nearby medical clinic that he refers all his patients to. Living on the street shaves 30 years off a person's life expectancy. The median age of death outside is about 52. The goal of street medicine is to proactively include people in a healthcare system that's otherwise inaccessible until they hitch a ride in an ambulance to the ER.
And how are you feeling now on these medications?
I love these medications because I'm not tired.
Shonda Thornton has been on several of those expensive hospital trips since she was diagnosed with congestive heart failure back in January.
How you feel when you walk a block or two?
I feel fine. I can walk all the way up to the 99 cent store and back.
She's in her 40s and has been in the hospital more than not this year.
September is the first month that I haven't.
Shonda's condition would be challenging even if she wasn't homeless. She was given a defibrillator vest and instructions to always wear it. But it malfunctions as she sweats through the summer living inside her nylon tent.
It was saying that I was having a heart attack, but I was just really perspiring a whole lot. So
she keeps the vest in its box in a shopping cart beside her tent. She doesn't have a place to charge it either.
It's like a pain in trying to keep it going.
So Dr. King works a compromise. Stay on her meds, get checked up in the clinic every now and then, and make sure her encampment neighbors know to call 911 if they see her in trouble. For Dr. King, the goal is to ensure Shonda has access to ongoing medical care that keeps her out of the ICU.
Street medicine has been a vehicle to stop the merry-go-round a little bit.
Corinne Feldman is a USC researcher who studies health outcomes for homeless patients. Reducing the merry-go-round trips in and out of the hospital by homeless people is basically the main reason there's more medical practitioners working on the street everywhere in the state than there ever has been before. LA County has almost 40 teams on any given weekday, reaching homeless people where they are.
There's a multitude of reasons why they might legitimately want to access that care, but they legitimately cannot.
Research shows that street medicine can encourage patients to more regularly seek medical attention. That can lead to reduced ER visits and greater overall trust between patients and homeless outreach providers. The reality is, though, people are going to be on the street for the foreseeable future. King says Californians need to look beyond the garbage and the tents and to really see the people out there who are struggling to survive.
The pitfall of labeling it a public health crisis, it becomes a reactionary, not in my backyard issue, where it doesn't need to be that. That's not what this is about. This is about the individuals who are sicker than the rest of us and are dying sooner than the rest of us.
That is, the squalid conditions on the street are mostly a risk for those who live in them, not so much the rest of us. As for Shonda, when it comes to getting off the street, she's actually doing better than most.
Right now, I have a voucher, I'm searching for housing.
A public housing voucher is a major step towards finding a home. The next is actually locating somewhere to use it. Her problem is just that she's been sick, though she's had several appointments to meet with property managers.
Every time I had an appointment or something, I would be in the hospital.
Which means her voucher is now close to expiring. Dr. King's job is to make sure she stays on her meds, stays out of the hospital, and actually has time to find a place to live. The street is no place to heal.
You can work on it. This is certainly a place to start working, but to fully heal out here, I don't think it's possible.
But it's the only place Shonda has to start. From Los Angeles, I'm Matt Tinoco.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Tyler Pratt. I recently sat down with two people working to get more food from Central Coast farms into more school lunches. In 2017, Aaron Primer, the director of food service for San Luis Coastal School District, began purchasing local food for the school meal program. The Farm to Lunch Tray effort is aimed at supporting local small farms and teaching kids about the fresh food all around them. The program continues to grow and is now helping other districts incorporate the local farm community into their meal plans. Primer joined me in the KCBX studios, along with Jeff Wade, executive director of Slow Money Slow, a group that helps financially support local farms. We kicked off the discussion with Wade explaining how he helps local farmers get the funding they need.
First, Slow has a W. It's actually a national movement started from the book Slow Money, Investing as if Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered. And that was written about 10 years ago, and there's dozen groups around the country. They all operate independently, do their own thing. But the common element is that we are here to help small local food and farm businesses to survive and grow. The Farm Slow program is an effort to shine a light on the needs of local small farmers to come up with programmatic elements that are devoted to supporting them.
And what are just a couple of needs for local farmers?
One of the key needs is an expansion of sales. A lot of them sell through farmers markets, which are good but very time-consuming and vary in terms of the weather and the location as to how good they are from a sales perspective. But we started out 4 years ago, three and a half, in terms of creating a farm-to-buyer mixer. So the idea was, okay, they have an outlet for consumers. They need to get to more institutional buyers. Restaurants, catering, private chefs, schools, other institutions. And we did two of those, 2 years in a row we did those, and that was the linkage effort at that time. And it worked reasonably well, but now we're focusing in on schools in particular and recognizing that they have a certain type of need that is a really good fit for small farmers, whereas restaurants can be more of a challenge in terms of those relationships getting set up.
And Erin, is this where you come in?
This is where I come in. So Jeff and I first met at the first Farm to Buyer Mixer, and it was an incredible event. We got to go to one space and meet a variety of different farmers who were featuring the abundance of what they produced. It was a great, great way for me to network and find out, well, who can I buy these things from and what can I buy? And it was such a great event where we not only got to meet these farmers and start relationships, but we've continued these relationships over the past couple of years. Lots of benefits for the farmers being able to work with schools as larger buyers, a little bit different like the farmers market client, where we're going to be a consistent buyer throughout the entire school year. We're really interested in piloting and promoting and really showing kids who these people are and what kind of great quality foods that they can bring into our program.
How did you both get started in this, and where did your passion come from?
My background is in business, marketing, sales, but I became an independent consultant about a dozen years ago, and that allowed me to work with a lot of different types of businesses. And the ones that I really enjoyed the most were the food and beverage type of businesses and farms. And
why is that?
Well, they probably needed my help the most. And everyone I worked with small businesses. They had small budgets, so it was helping them to figure out what best to do with their small marketing budgets. But the food and farm businesses were especially challenging because they had difficulty growing and they needed help getting beyond a certain threshold. And when the Slow Money book was put in front of me, I realized, okay, this is an area that they really need help in, and that is funding. So we started establishing peer-to-peer lending relationships. So small businesses, food and farm, that could not grow because they didn't have the funding and they couldn't qualify for bank loans, needed some help, and they had already exhausted friends and family Kickstarter. So we do peer-to-peer lending, which is facilitating an individual making a loan directly to a food business owner. And that's been really exciting. I coach them, prepare them, monitor them after they've gotten the loans, and we've done over $1.2 million in loans in 7 years.
Cool. So Erin, tell me about where your passion comes from.
So I've lived all up and down California, and I've always worked in food. Seeing catering and retail sides of things, I've always had an idea of having great food. And when I got into school food, I brought that same idea that kids should have great food too. And a lot about having these great food experiences are understanding where your food comes from and really getting the chance to taste it. So my passion really comes from wanting to bring a higher level experience around food to our students. And a lot of times, it may be the first time that they've had a food experience, like with an heirloom tomato and seeing the different colors that tomatoes can be. And it's really powerful to be able to help educate kids about where food comes from, more about our food system. And I really think that this work is building respect back into our food system so that kids really understand that things don't magically show up from the grocery store.
Is this a new concept, or is this something that's growing everywhere? Because I remember my school lunches were not great. Is this a novel concept, or is this happening across the United States?
You know, it's not actually that novel. It's almost come full circle, where when the school lunch program started in the 1950s, we saw a lot more scratch cooking and getting more real foods in schools. And then we went into this quick convenience package process model, and now we're almost seeing this come back full circle. Even when San Luis Coastal had, 50 years ago, we had a baker who made all of our delicious breads in-house, and that's not a position we've had in years. So to really see us kind of going back to the roots of where food comes from and how we can make more of that fresh for kids, we really think that's where it's at, where kids are going to want to really taste the difference. It's been really important for us to see what other districts are doing as far as farm to school goes. There's a big effort in this movement nationwide where schools are now looking at what we've done for a number of years and why we don't have better food. So it's really part of a current institutional paradigm shift, but it's definitely going back to the roots of the beginnings of these types of programs.
What changed there for a while where the quality diminished in school food?
I think with school food and also with our just general food system, we've relied so much on convenience. We've relied so much on heating something up, microwaving it, making it quick, fast, and easy. We see this with fast food as well. And that's what really attracts me to slow money and this idea of slowing money down, slowing food down, really getting back to these basics of putting quality, real things in place to benefit our overall wellness perspective and benefit our whole bodies.
The first big question is this cost effective for schools to get local fresh produce? This is an idea that a lot of times we think of as expensive.
It is. And I think that, you know, even in the retail world, when we see that, you know, I can buy a burger for a dollar and a salad is $5, that definitely speaks to the economics of health. And, you know, at what cost are we willing to not invest in food and not invest in quality? It's interesting because at San Luis Coastal, we really see this as a longer term cost model. It's not something that's going to be solved today. And it's something that initially, and just looking on paper and statistics and numbers, doesn't appear to be cost effective. However, it's really an investment. It's an investment in our health. When we look at diseases and illnesses that children are facing, with obesity being at the front of that argument, how can we afford not to have better food? How can we afford not to feature local farms and finding things as fresh to the source as we possibly can? So this really isn't just a what am I having for lunch today and is that cost effective? It's really a much longer term picture on how are we investing in health and wellness in our future. We have been able to find ways to make this more cost effective for us, meaning when we tell a story about our food, when we tell a story about how this item has come to the table, we find that kids are more engaged with that. They're more inclined to eat that strawberry when they know the farmer that grew it and they've seen pictures of how it's grown on the farm. So we also look at this from a food waste model. There's a lot of regulations and requirements that we have from USDA within our school meal program. For example, we are required to serve a bean once a week in schools. If I open a can of beans and put them on the salad bar, they're all going to go in the trash at the end of lunch. So we've had to come up with really creative ways to meet the requirements, but do it in a fun way where we get kids to really understand and appreciate what we're doing. We now have chocolate hummus on the menu, and it's beans, and we sell out of it. Pair that with some local strawberries for dipping, and you've got a really amazing piece of a meal that speaks volumes to much more than just the cost.
When you say story, is there a story that's really connected with kids that comes to mind?
Definitely. I think one of my favorite stories is an event that we had last year at Bishop's Peak Elementary, and we brought Larry Kandarian out from Kandarian Organic Farm, and we tasted farro with kids and had it on the menu. And I admit that was a little farro out. Yes, I am a food pun fanatic. And it was really fun for kids to be able to meet this farmer, ask him questions, taste the product that he had. And the best part was that at Farmer's Market in the next coming weeks, there was a student who recognized Larry and brought his mom over and was like, "Mom, this is Larry. We ate farro at school. Can we buy this and bring it home?" And I think that really speaks to what we're trying to do is that, yes, I want kids to have amazing food and have that amazing food experience at school. But bigger than that, they're bringing these experiences home. And when they are in charge of their own consumer purchasing in the future, I think this is how we're going to keep our local farm sustainable.
So you'll have an event coming up.
We do. We have an event on October 5th, and it is a farm-to-table dinner, as you might guess. Aaron will be speaking there as well. And it is a benefit really for the Farm Slow program that has been growing here over the last year or so within Slow Money. And that program has direct benefits to the farmers, and helping them to be in more schools is one of those. But realize that the help to the farmers is also a help to the community. You know, we believe that food that's grown, caught, raised, or produced locally helps to build a thriving economy, vibrant soil, a healthy population, and a quality food system. So the event is all about that, is helping support that effort. And it's at Tiber Canyon Ranch in San Luis Obispo. It is being curated, the menu, all the cooking is by Slow Provisions on Monterey Street, which is a great local farm-to-table type of restaurant. They also have the cafe on site at Mind Body. We've got music, we've got art. The San Luis and Outdoor Painters for the Environment, Slope, have been to some of these farms and have painted their farms and will have those for sale. The farmers will be there. They get a free ticket. You know, they're coming. Meet the farmer. Find out more about the food. Every ingredient in the menu is listed in the program with contact information, what farmers markets to go to buy their food. We want people to come away from that and support these farmers, as well as the other folks that are really supporting us, Edo Pasta, Central Coast Creamery Cheeses. It's just going to be a great combination of local food.
Talk to me about getting this program rolling and getting into schools. What were some of the challenges that you faced getting this up and going? I can't imagine that it was easy to start.
It's definitely not easy, but it's well worth it. And I think that's what drives me to do this work and to have amazing partners like Jeff and Slow Money Slow. They've really helped us grow our local sourcing, enhancing wellness, food awareness in schools, and all while supporting our small local farms. So even though it's been a challenge in trying to figure these pieces out, it's been incredible with the amount of support that we have and the amount of abundance that we have in Slow County. It really is amazing, and it makes that work a little bit easier. And I'm also a big proponent of sharing this message. This by no means is unique to me or San Luis Coastal. We've never had a child who has changed districts because of the food. That would be an amazing compliment, but that's not how it works. So the more that we can share these resources, share with other school districts. I'm part of a Central Coast School Nutrition Co-op, which is 11 local school districts that come together for purchasing. And we're now asking a lot more questions about how do we get the best pricing on the best quality food? We want to come together and support these local farms. And really for us, it's about creating much better school food experiences than what we experienced in our past.
What have been some of the benefits for the farmers, Jeff?
Well, they're starting to experience them. This program is still at a very small level right now, but I think that they are finding an outlet for their produce that they didn't expect. I think they felt, as you did, that, you know, how can they afford this from schools? And Aaron's found out a way to do it and is helping others in Slow County food districts to figure it out. They have a good program set up to do that, and I think that they will, over time, benefit greatly by having a consistent buyer that isn't maybe as seasonal, that is willing to take a lot of different types of produce. So it's great for me to get to meet new farmers and for Aaron and her students to get the wellness and educational aspect. So I think they'll enjoy that part of it too over time. We've got a lot of ideas, work to do, that we want to make it easier for the farmers to sell.
Such as?
Well, we feel like perhaps the infrastructure that's set up at the school districts for transportation of food could be leveraged. If we can reduce the amount of deliveries, travel that the farmers have to do, if we could pick up at farmers markets, or if we could have them deliver more central locations. We're actually looking at some grant funding, perhaps, if we can get our act together to support development of an application that would link up the food services directors and the farmers. That will take a lot of work and a lot of training on both sides. And we need to do some research to make sure that's going to work and make sure it's really beneficial.
What kind of assistance are you looking for from the public or from officials?
The number one assistance is our goal, which is buy more local food. And if they're doing that, that's outstanding. Do more of it. We have a lot of awareness of what we're doing, but we're pretty unique in terms of what we're doing, I must say. You know, there's a lot of great organizations in the county doing wonderful things. But a focus on the small agriculture and food segment of what we have locally isn't necessarily there. So I would love to have anybody that wants to support us to get involved. Slowmoneyslow.org, S-L-O-W, money, S-L-O.org. And on that homepage are all the details about the event. Come to the event or give me a call, write me an email, say you want to be involved. Help me plan out my objectives for 2020, and let's get more people involved that can help me do more.
What are some of the challenges that farmers face after they've grown their product to get it out, to get it sold?
In terms of deciding how much to grow, what to grow, and how to sell it, they're making their best guesses based on years past, based on people that they meet. There's never typically any kind of guaranteed purchase contracts. They are always in danger of maybe not having the right product at the right time or enough product at the right time, especially, you know, people involved with small-scale ranching. If you can't provide enough of a product to a particular restaurant, they may not want to feature it at all. And I would love for the public to be asking restaurants, where are you getting your food from? I know a lot of them are doing great work with buying locally, but I just feel like they don't promote it enough, you know, really wave the flag, you know, wildly, so that that becomes something that people really need. And then some of these other challenges might not be as difficult if there's more places for them to sell their product. Farmers markets are great, but we have a lot of them, but sometimes they're hard to get into. There are small farmers, maybe new farmers, that maybe can't get into some of the best markets. They will start in the ones they can get into, but it's a lot of work to do a farmers market every week, and many of them do them, you know, 2, 3, 4 a week. You know, there's a new market at Farm Supply on Tuesday afternoons. I would encourage people to go to that one. That's an up-and-coming market. The Morro Bay Market on Saturday is back in place, and that's growing greater than ever. Go to that market and try some of the products that are there. There's also value-added food products, which we support a lot as well.
Things What's that
are that? Produced. A value-added food product would be like a hummus made from the garbanzo beans. It would be kombucha, you know, Whalebird kombucha. We're big fans of them, and it's one of the food businesses we help support to grow to where they are today with funding. You know, that the challenges are great in terms of the farmer ability to sell their product at a fair price and not have a lot left over. The school districts are a great opportunity because they're not necessarily as choosy in terms of the condition of the product or the variety of, you know, they don't all need to be the same size avocado. And I think that's one of the great reasons why we feel like that's a project that will do a lot for the local farms.
Does this program help teach kids, which this is sort of a learning curve for me throughout my life, about learning to eat more seasonally and eat locally, and maybe you don't need to have the same food all year round?
Definitely, and that is definitely a challenge. We see kids who really want to eat that same banana every day with their breakfast, and I've yet to find a local banana. And so it's important that we have these conversations. It's important to show kids and model this behavior of what a seasonal plum tastes like right now and have those experiences for them. We do this in our lunchrooms, and we create safety. You don't have to eat it, or you don't have to eat the whole thing. Take a bite. Try it. See what you think. I think we've converted a few friends of, wow, I didn't know how much I liked this, and this is really tasty and amazing. So getting kids to break out of that shell of comfortability and I have the same thing to eat every day is really important as we embark on eating seasonally and being willing to try and taste new things in a very safe environment. I think a lot of this does come down to nutrition education about the item, but really telling the story about how that item got to the plate. We really find that that has helped build respect back into our food system. And it's been a great way to connect students with farmers. What does the farmer of today look like? What questions do you have for them? And I think it's been mutually beneficial for both the student and the farmer. We do things in the cafeteria, in the classroom. We really try and create opportunities so that kids can have more experience with the food system and know that it doesn't come out of a package.
What does the farmer of today look like?
The farmer of today looks different than I think the farmer of yesterday. One of my favorite farming duos is Robinsong Farm with Brandon and Roxanne. They actually came out and tasted heirloom tomatoes with the class that we had. And I think kids are really surprised that these were young farmers, that these are people who are making a career out of farming. And I think that's a really important message for Slo County. We're such a big ag community. For kids to see real life experiences about potential career paths is really important to know what their futures may look like.
That was Aaron Primer, Director of Food Service for the San Luis Coastal School District, and Jeff Wade, Executive Director of Slo Money Slo. They will be hosting a benefit dinner to support the local farming community on October 5th. The entire dinner, called Bounty of the Harvest, will feature local food and showcase the farmers who grew it. We're going to take a short break. When we return, a local farmer will teach us about the many uses of lavender in cooking and cocktails.
You see a lot of bars these days are offering like lavender-infused martinis or margaritas. They mix it with tequila, vodka, gin.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas.
This is KCPX, Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
Who told you so, dilly dilly, who told you so? 'Twas my own heart, dilly dilly, that told me so.
In the early summer, many of our yards are dotted with the vibrant purple flowers of lavender. In addition to the splash of color they give to our golden lawns, they bring honeybees and the graceful yet elusive hummingbird. The heavenly scent of lavender relaxes us when the dried buds are put in sachets and dotted around the house, and the occasional bouquet adorns a table or enhances a flower arrangement. But did you know that lavender has many culinary uses? There are a couple of lavender farms along the Central Coast, and I visited one specifically to find out how I could use lavender in my everyday cooking.
I'm Sean Crowder. I'm the CFO for Claremont Farms. I make a lot of the products in the shop, and I help folks learn about lavender and its historical uses and what you can do with it today.
Claremont Farms is tucked away between Los Olivos and San Ynez in Santa Barbara County. As I got out of the car, the scent of lavender was strong enough to be pleasant, but moderate enough to not be distracting. It was the end of the lavender season, and the bright purple heads on the stems of lavender that were left had faded to be, well, lavender in color. When I sat down with Sean, we of course started from the beginning.
We use two kinds of lavender here, primarily Grosso. I also do have some Provence. We've got about 3,500 3-year-old Grossos. I put in 1,200 1-year-old Grossos out there. I'm going to be putting another 4,000.
Wow, that's a lot of lavender plants. Is it native to California?
No, not at all. Lavender was brought over to the United States. There's a lot of debate and arguing about where it popped up, either Northern Africa, India, Southern Europe, different areas over there. It was utilized by the ancient Greeks. It also appears in the Bible under the name spikenard. So it has a lot of historical documentation, but a exact point of origin, I have no idea.
And like with every non-native species, you've got to figure out the right growing conditions. We're between Solvang and Los Olivos, mm-hmm. So we're kind of in a dry inland valley. Does it like that kind of stuff?
It depends on the kind, but what I grow primarily is French, which really prefers the Mediterranean climate. There are English and Spanish varieties that work nicely by the coast and can be grown inland, but what I have here, primarily Grosso and Provence, prefer drier climates. The humidity will kill them faster than anything. Being too kind to them, giving them too much water, is the best way to kill a lavender plant.
When is lavender season?
It varies. So a lot of English and Spanish you start seeing blooming in, late February, March, April. That's when a lot of people arrive expecting my field to be in bloom. The French is more of the June, July. It does have a variation depending on the season and how the weather is going. If it's very hot early in the year, everything can shift forward 2 to 3 weeks. If it's very cool, it can actually move backwards. Like with our field, an average year, the bloom is typically between the 10th to the 20th of June through to the 20th to 30th of July for its peak.
And only one crop a year?
Yes. There are certain kinds of lavender, some English and Spanish, as well as like one or two French types. I couldn't name them at the moment that do give you a second bloom. It's usually not as big as the first. Like Spanish is lovely. Like some of the varieties of Spanish are lovely because they will bloom periodically, like 3-4 times a year. But mostly with the French, it's once per year.
So here we are in your field, and your field isn't actually 100% plants at the moment.
No,
but you're planting more, right?
Yeah, we're in the process of replanting. One of the annoying things about Grosso is that because it is a hybrid, it does die off randomly. Like you can see one or two there in line with others that are perfectly healthy, and they'll just go on you. We're going to put in 4,000 this coming winter and really finish filling it out. Grosso typically is a full sun plant, but with the way our weather and summers have turned, it's seeming to be acceptable at partial shade now.
These plants here,
I'm
assuming that if I would have come a month ago, they would have been bright purple,
yes,
as you described.
Yeah.
But when you harvest it, do you just whack off 12 inches and sell them as a bunch?
It really depends on what you want to do with it. But in essence, like if you kind of look out there, you can see how we round them. We cut to the base of the stem, but we don't cut into the leafy section underneath. One of the biggest mistakes that people make is they think you need to hedge lavender back, kind of like a rose, or you need to give it a really heavy cutting, that's really playing with fire. If you cut into the woody undergrowth, you can cause shock and kill the plant actually very easily. And one of the main reasons people do that is that they do manage to raise the lavender till it's about 4 or 5 years of age. They notice it kind of collapse to the sides and it leaves a big woody hole in the middle. That's completely normal. You just really have to be patient and allow the plant to regrow and fill that space, which it will.
Now that you know how to care for your lavender, let's find out how you can cook with it.
Kind of the more American experience of lavender has mostly always just been like a scent and a color. If you're using Herbes de Provence, they do typically add lavender into that. But yes, different kinds of lavender are more or less suitable for use in food. Like the Grosso is very useful for oil. It produces a lot of oil per bud because it doesn't have a seed taking up space. Whereas the Provence produces less oil, but is ideal for use in food items, which is why I grow it. The Provence is nice to use in salts, peppers. You can mix it into honey, tea, into all kinds of things. Do a scone mix, both a lavender and a white chocolate lavender scone mix. Sometimes folks will take it and make a simple syrup with it and then mix it into drinks. You see a lot of bars these days are offering like lavender infused martinis or margaritas. They mix it with tequila, vodka, gin, but it does work nicely as a spice. It has a savory kind of flavor to it. If it's done correctly, it's like using rosemary or sage. I don't mix the oil in. The oil only goes into like lotions, creams, scrubs, and sprays.
Okay.
One of the big errors that does happen if people mix oil in and it just ruins it, it becomes immediately bitter, it takes away the flavor. You typically don't want to mix in the oil. That's kind of what I was meaning. People will make simple syrup with it. And that's more of what you might see, like you don't want to mix the oil in because it will overwhelm and destroy the flavor.
So if I was doing this at home, say I had a Provence lavender plant, would I just take the full bloom buds and shake them over my scone mix?
What you want to do is cut the stems, let the stems either dry in a bundle upside down in a nice aerated place. It could take a week or two. You can also sun dry it if you like. It's faster, it loses its color. And then I would say put it into a box or a bag and just bash it against the wall or a table. The buds will pop right off the stems. You can also string it off with your fingers, but be careful. These stems can actually cut you if you're not careful. Once then you want to let them dry for another couple days. The bud has a chaff around it that looks like a brown sticky dust. It takes about a week or so to kind of dry and start to flake off. And then I would say put it into a little sieve and just stir it around and shake it for a while. You'll see the dust drop off and just kind of keep cleaning it until you're left with a nice smooth blue bud. Then from there, typically you don't use whole buds except for like decoration on some desserts. When you want to mix it into salt, pepper, spices, take a coffee grinder, or you can also use a mortar and pestle if you don't have one, and you just want to mash it, grind it up nice and fine, and then lightly mix it in. If you want to mix it into teas, you can use that whole bud that you've cleaned.
Do you sell lavender in a form that people could use in their kitchen?
Yeah, we do. We sell little 4-ounce containers of the culinary lavender that's cleaned and ready to go.
So what was the process in finding the right amount of lavender to use in the products that you do have? Like the tea, you know, that's pretty easy. But for the scones, you have to keep baking scone after scone. Is that how you do it?
The scone recipe was figured out by a company, so I can't take any credit for that. They did a lovely job with it. Yeah, I would strongly recommend some experimentation and just be prepared to not enjoy the cookies a couple of times before you get it right. Don't worry about it. You'll just get better and better at it as you go. The teas and spices, they've been around for a long time, so you can figure out some of these quantities by experimentation or just doing some research on the subject. You've got plenty of leeway when it comes to the teas. If you're going to do a cup of tea, I would do no more than like a teaspoon, I'd say, of bud. If you feel like the lavender is a little weak, you can just give it a little press with the mortar and pestle, or just kind of give it a little crush with the spoon before you drop it in and stir it around.
I really want to know more about the culinary uses, so we head into the gift shop and take the conversation further from there.
These are the culinary goodies. We do the culinary lavender by itself, and then we have the Herbes de Provence, sea salt, pepper, Himalayan salt, and then we have the green tea, Earl Grey, rooibos, chamomile. We also do honey, and then we have the scone mixes that we do with it here.
I have seen scones, lavender shortbread, the tea. but are there things that you would avoid?
Yeah, I've ruined a lot of meals with it. Lavender is something you want to use in addition to another flavor that's strong, like lemon, chocolate, honey, teas it works nicely in. Lavender is meant to be complementary and not the primary flavor. You'll see also lavender ice cream. In most cases, people balance it with so much sugar to try and make the flavor more palatable that it's too sweet. If you want to have some real fun, you can put it on cheddar cheese or brie, eggs, potatoes, salmon. It's lovely on salmon, especially a baked salmon. You can use it on pretty much anything. Like I've used the lavender honey on lamb. It's absolutely delicious.
So what are some of the meals that you've destroyed?
Oh gosh, plenty of salads. I've tried to mix it in. I've tried to even blend it into like dressings and that just does not work out. I've overdone it on chicken. I've overdone it on pork. Yeah, I once tried a lavender shortbread cookie that was so strong that even just the smell of it when I pulled it out of the oven, I just knew it was not going to work out. I took one sacrificial bite of it and chucked the rest immediately. If you overdo it, it's done. That's typically why we sell the culinary, the Provence, angustifolia, because if you use the grosso, it's just so easy to cross that threshold and destroy the meal.
You wouldn't ease in with like roast beef?
I typically don't recommend starting with meats or things that are a little more expensive to cook with. No. You can do it on something like beef because it has its own nice strong flavor to it, but just go easy on it. It works very well if you're going to give it time to absorb in the oven or like in the crock pot. I just recommend starting with small batches before you really dive in on a big piece, especially if you've got to feed the family and you would like to see them again for the next meal.
What about like a lavender cream sauce or something like that?
That is a little outside of my normal range for cooking. I have tried it as a spice on top of pasta before, like an Alfredo. Wasn't crazy about it, but that's just me. Have fun and be prepared to ruin a dish or two. I think you'll have some fun with it.
Time to have some fun. I bought a jar of the culinary lavender and a jar of the lavender-infused honey. I disregarded all of Sean's safety precautions and went straight for a cream sauce over meat and a tasty little cocktail. I like a challenge, so I'm gonna do a cream sauce. Sean said he hadn't experimented with cream sauces, so I'm gonna try a cream sauce. Yeah, there are some things online, but I'm gonna try to make my own. I'm gonna start with finely chopping some onions and garlic. And I'm gonna include in there some Parmesan cheese, a little bit of wine, and then of course, cream. When it comes to the lavender, I'm going to take Sean's advice and use it very sparingly. I'm gonna start by lightly sauteing the onions and garlic. I'm sauteing them in butter, which will complement the cream, of course, because it's all dairy fat, and I love dairy fat. And I'm not gonna let them get brown, I'm just gonna do it a little bit. I'm going to pour a little bit of local Chardonnay in there. I'm going to pour in some cream, and I don't want the pan too hot. If it's too hot, my cream will curdle. Stir that around a little bit. And because I'm using heavy whipping cream and I don't want it to be that heavy, I'm going to put in a little bit of milk. I'm going to add a grind of salt and a couple grinds of pepper. Stir that around a little bit. And now I'm going to add just about a half a teaspoon of the culinary lavender that I got at Claremont Farms. It's very, very fragrant. Smells like a lavender field. Smells exactly like lavender. Putting that in to the cream sauce. I'm going to let the cream warm up. I'm not going to let it boil. And then I'm going to turn it off and set it aside and let the flavors of the lavender soak into the cream. I can smell the lavender, the cream, the wine, the onions and the garlic. I'm gonna let all of those flavors blend together while I cook my pork steak. This is a nice pork loin steak, and I'm going to salt and pepper both sides. And I'm going to cook it on a very hot cast iron pan with a little bit of oil. I'm gonna serve the pork with some mini pasta. As the pork is resting, because you need to let meat rest and relax after you cook it, I'm going to strain the cream sauce and take out all of the solids. I'm going to put it back on a very low heat, and I'm going to thicken it up a little bit by adding some grated Parmesan cheese. I'm going to whisk that around a little bit, and then I'm going to put that over my pork and pasta. So my cream sauce is a bit thicker. It's still thin for a cream sauce, but it's a bit thicker. I'm going to pour that over the pork and the pasta. I'm going to garnish it with the lavender that lines my driveway. And bon appetit. Okay, so we have this pork steak in a lavender cream sauce with some pasta. Pork cooked perfectly. Douse it in the cream sauce, and let's see how it tastes. Mmm, that was the perfect amount of lavender. I can taste the pork. And there's this little hint of lavender, which is about perfect. Sean was right. Use it sparingly. I can definitely taste the lavender. Is it good with just the pasta? It's very nice on the pasta. And I think the key is that I didn't use too much. Thank you, Sean, for that advice. And this is definitely something that I would make again, and I would make for guests. So I recommend that you get some culinary lavender, or if you have some Provence lavender of your own growing in your backyard or front yard, go ahead and give it a try. It's a really nice combination. Sean also mentioned lavender simple syrup for cocktails. I'm just going to dive in with the lavender honey and the lavender buds themselves. Now I want to do something with this lavender honey, and I'm thinking I want to make a cocktail with it. I'm not a mixologist, so I took some advice from online, and I found the tequila honeybee cocktail, which looks like it was invented by bartender Nick Corby at the Egg Shop in New York City. It has tequila, a mezcal rinse, honey, lemon juice, and Angostura bitters, all of which I have. And instead of regular honey, I'm going to use the lavender honey, and instead of lemon, I'm going to use lime. And I'm going to try this two different ways. I'm going to try this following this recipe with those substitutions, and then I'm going to try it with a different spirit, like vodka or moonshine, which I actually have, commercial moonshine. And I'm going to see which one tastes better, if either of them taste any good at all. So here goes. Mezcal is the same thing as tequila, but it's from a different part of Mexico. It's from Oaxaca, and it's smoked. So it's a smoked version of tequila, and it's very smoky, this one that I have. The recipe calls for a mezcal rinse, and I'm only doing that one for the tequila. So I put a drop of mezcal in the glass. I swish it around so it coats the sides of the glass, and then I pour it out. And then I go on to make the rest of the drink. Squeeze the limes. Pour the lime in the shaker, half in one, half in the other. Put the tequila in one. Put the moonshine in the other. The lavender honey doesn't smell too much like lavender. Since it's not too lavender smelling, I'm gonna add just a few grains of lavender in the shaker. And then I'm gonna shake each one of them vigorously, both of them at the same time. Now strain into a glass. A dash or two of Angostura bitters in each one. And now it's time to taste it. First, I'm going to taste the one made from the moonshine because the mezcal will make the other one more smoky and should be tried second. Interesting. I can taste the lime. I can taste a hint of lavender. I could have probably put more honey in it because it's not that sweet, but I was kind of concerned about honey being super sweet. Tasty. Now the tequila with mezcal. Ooh, that's really nice. Actually, the tequila, the mezcal with this hint of lavender in the background, super nice. I thought it was going to clash with the tequila and clash with the mezcal, the smokiness of the mezcal, but it's actually really nice. If you want to try a lavender-infused tequila honeybee cocktail, get yourself some reposado tequila, some mezcal, some lavender honey, some lavender buds, some lime juice, and some dashes of Angostura bitters. And make this cocktail, give it a try, and it's great for a nice hot summer day. Lavender produced a delicious meal and a delicious cocktail. It's definitely worth a try. The only reason I was successful was that I actually did listen to Sean's advice. Take it easy with the lavender at the start.
There are several farms on the Central Coast you can visit. If you are growing the Provence variety of lavender, you can follow Sean's instructions to produce your own culinary stock. Lavender is yet another gem in the cornucopia of produce we enjoy here on the Central Coast, so take advantage of its availability and usability in your kitchen. You will be pleasantly surprised. This is KCPX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.